Hi, everyone, and welcome back, finally, to season 3 of Wild Connection, the podcast. It's been a while, and one of the reasons is because I have been here, where I am right now, windy, impenetrable forest in Uganda, because I'm here as a Fulbright scholar. And part of my Fulbright was creating a special series called Voices of Uganda. And this is the kickoff episode to that series. Now, it also happens to be Women's History Month. So, well, it's going to start with some women. Now, my guest today is Dr. Gladys Kalima Zikusoka. She is not only a wildlife veterinarian, but she is the founder and CEO of Conservation Through Public Health, an author, and we're going to be talking about her new book, Walking with Gorillas, The Journey of an African Wildlife Vet. And she has been named a finalist in the prestigious Indianapolis Conservation Prize. Coincidentally, she's also my Fulbright host. I hope you'll tune in to this special season and this special series. For now, let's go to my guest. Dr. Gladys Kalima Zikusoka, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Dr. Jennifer.
I am so delighted to have you, and I really appreciate you making time because I know that you are getting ready for a whirlwind tour right now for the launch of your book, Walking with Gorillas, The Journey of an African Wildlife Vet. Are you excited about that?
I am very excited. It's the first time I've written a book like this one. And yeah, it's very exciting. Doing a talk about my book will be exciting.
Yeah,
I'm a little bit nervous though.
Well, you know, I've gotten to know you a little bit over the last 8 months, and I know you're going to do great. And I wish I could be there for that talk. But I'm so glad I have you here. And you know, before we dive into your fascinating and exhilarating book, talk to me a little bit about where you grew up.
I grew up in Kampala, the capital city of Uganda. And I was actually somebody, I'd never actually experienced the countryside until I started working with wildlife. But I grew up in Kampala and I was the last born of a family of six. And I grew up with lots of pets at home. My older sister, who I follow, was just outside my age bracket for playing. She's 5.5 years older than me. So we never really played much, and the cats and dogs became my very good friends. And that shaped my future career to become a veterinarian and later to work with wildlife.
That's great. Well, you know, I can relate to that, as other animals were my friends too when I was younger. And so do you think that this was the primary way you connected with nature when you were younger? And how did that change as you got older?
I would say that my first experience connecting with nature was, there's a monkey that lived across the road called Poncho. Uh-huh. And it's a velvet monkey belonging to the Cuban ambassador and his wife. And once Poncho realized that our home had many animals, many cats and dogs, and there was a child to play with, he used to jump over the fence, come over a gate, and then jump down and start playing with the animals. He used to pull the cats and dogs' tails. He used to like steal food from the kitchen. He was really, really mischievous. But one time I was playing the piano and I felt like I wasn't alone. And I looked over my shoulder and Poncho was watching me. So I moved out of the room to see what he'd do. And he played one note. I was just like, what? I can't believe this monkey can play the piano. And I ran in, and of course he ran away. And that got me fascinated with primates. I realized not only do they look, you know, their fingers look like ours and they're very similar to us, but they're very intelligent as well. So I'd say that was a beginnings of trying to, you know, my fascination with primates. But then it wasn't until I set up a wildlife club at my high school in Uganda, and we visited Queen Elizabeth National Park, mm-hmm. when I was in my final year, and we took children, we're about 20 of us, with the teacher, And that was a life-changing experience for me because, you know, we got to be out in the wild and go on walking safaris and see the wildlife. And it was just amazing and magical. And it made me then want to become a vet who works with wildlife as well.
That's incredible. And, you know, I think many people listening don't fully appreciate how challenging it is, not just for people in Uganda in general, but women in particular, to gain an education. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, in Uganda, it's, you know, it's always been a country where the girl child was never prioritized. And it was easier, especially in the rural areas, for when somebody has children, they prioritize the boys to go to school because they feel that the girls are going to just come and work on the land. And especially a community like Bwindi Forest, it used to be that, you know, most girls became pregnant as teenagers and then they just got married off. And so then that was the end of their life. And so by the age of 25, someone would have had five children, by the age of 36, 10. And there wasn't much prioritization for girl child education. But it's beginning to change over time, although the rural areas still have a lot of, you know, a lot of young women who have never been to school. But in the urban areas, where I grew up in Kampala, it was a bit different. The, you know, everyone went to school. And the government of Uganda started universal primary education. But it's still, a lot of people still feel it's the boys who should be going to school and the girls, it's not always necessary for them to go to school. But that's changing over time. Because once you educate your daughter, then she's going to have a much brighter future. And I think most people are beginning to realize that.
Yeah. And for you, you had the opportunity also to go to school outside of Uganda. And, you know, I have been here in a place really different and far from home for 8 months. And, you know, I've experienced part of the isolation and often the loneliness that comes with living somewhere where things are so radically different, including culturally different. And you attended schools.
Yes.
Right. And you attended schools in Scotland and then veterinary school in London. You know, what was it like for you the first time you went outside of Uganda and attended school? What was that experience for you?
It was quite, it was exciting, but daunting at the same time. I was lucky that in Scotland, people were so friendly. The Scottish are really friendly and warm. So that helped a lot. And when I attended that school, I was there with my cousins. And my sister had been there earlier. So they just used to call me Ronnie's little sister. And that helped a lot.
Okay.
That helped a lot. But in my class, I would say that when I joined the school, I was the only Black girl in the whole year. Uh-huh. And in my class, there was, in the whole school at one point, when my cousins left, because I was with them for 1 year, then they went. At one point, I was the only Black girl in the whole school with two other boys from Uganda. And that was quite something. But everybody was so friendly and welcoming. So that was, that helped a lot. That helped a lot. I would say what was most isolating, I miss my mom because I was 12 years old at the time. I missed, you know, having a familiar. I missed the food of Uganda. I missed the warm weather. There were so many things that I missed out there because Scotland was a very cold country.
Yes.
It still is. So, yeah, I just missed the sunshine and things like that. I really did. But the people were really friendly. And I think it was a great place for me to be for those 2 years. And I've actually reconnected with my friends in Scotland, in Dollar Academy, because what's interesting is one of them who was in my year, Jacqueline Smith, she ended up heading BBC Science in Scotland. And her team came and filmed our work in 2018 for a show on BBC, which was covering primates.
Uh-huh.
And so it was really exciting to reconnect. And then when I returned in 2022, last year, where I was greatly honored to receive the Edinburgh Medal Award, she got me to go back to my old school and give a talk The rector was excited to meet me. And then I also got to meet some of my old friends who had been following me. Mm-hmm. And it was just good to make that reconnection. Even if we were worlds apart, we could still connect again.
Yeah.
And we can still do things together, which is exciting.
Well, and what a coincidence that a schoolmate became the head of science, BBC Science. And, you know, you have made such an impact in the world of conservation for mountain gorillas. And we are going to get to your book, Walking with Gorillas, the Journey of African Wildlife Vet. But, you know, I really love for people to get a sense of who you are and what your journey was. And, you know, you attended veterinary school, not only in London, but you also, where we share a connection is through NC State. And so you mentioned earlier that kind of Poncho, the vervet monkey, started to shift your interest towards primates, and then heading the Wildlife Club, you know, and going to Queen Elizabeth really sparked your passion for wildlife. You know, where in veterinary school did you start to really be able to concentrate on wildlife as opposed to, you know, livestock or domestic animals?
I would say that in vet school, we were allowed to work with animals of our choice in the holidays when I was still in London, the Royal Vet College. So I got to work with chimpanzees in Entebbe Zoo, which were victims of the bushmeat trade. And that was really special. I spent a week with them and they kept escaping from the cages because the cages were a bit flimsy and they loved being carried back. They were so intelligent. And then I returned again a year later and worked with chimpanzees in Budongo Forest, which was really, it was my first time to study primates in the wild. And that was really fascinating. I was looking at parasites in their fecal samples. And then I returned 2 years later to Bwindi to work with the mountain gorillas. So that was really fascinating as well. And yeah, so that's, I really got an opportunity to, even before I started working as Uganda's first wildlife vet, I had those experiences, which actually helped me a lot mm-hmm. when I started working in UWA, in Uganda Wildlife Authority.
Well, you know, it's interesting that your first experience was with chimpanzees and not mountain gorillas. You know, I worked with chimpanzees and what you said about them escaping and wanting to be carried back reminded me. So I volunteered with the Center for Great Apes for many years in Florida. And I used to go into an enclosure with one of the chimps, Kenya, and share lunch mm-hmm. until the day that she stole my keys and attempted, there were so many keys and she, you know, I mean, I'm sure you know, having worked with chimps, they're quite impulsive. They don't have a ton of patience. Mm-hmm. And she knew that keys opened locks, but mm-hmm. she couldn't figure out which key. And then that became my fault. And I got slapped and bit. And
oh no.
Oh yes. And I was humiliated. Here I was supposedly the smart human, and I had to radio someone to say, Kenya stole my keys and I'm locked in the cage with her. Please come rescue me. And I never put myself in that position ever again. but what's fascinating for me is that your first experience was with chimps, not mountain gorillas. And so looking mm-hmm. back on it now, you know, what do you think drew you more towards mountain gorillas rather than continuing to concentrate on chimpanzees?
I do also love the chimpanzees. But I would say that gorillas are so gentle. Mm-hmm. And so vulnerable. And actually, gorillas are much fewer. The mountain gorillas are much fewer in number. So I felt that they needed more help than the chimpanzees. As much as the chimpanzees are also threatened, actually endangered. But I kind of liked the gentle nature of gorillas. Unfortunately, King Kong makes them seem to be fierce. But right. Gorillas are more predictable. They're more gentle. They say that chimps is what we are and gorillas is what we want to be. So
yeah, that's a good description. I mean, I love chimps too, but I completely agree with your sentiment. You know, the gorillas are much. Why do you think they've been given such a fierce King Kong image? You know, when in fact, you know, they're pretty. They, from what I've seen, right? They lay around and they eat and they fart a lot and they rest a lot.
Probably, I would say that the person who first discovered the mountain gorillas, maybe the time that they discovered them, it was for, you know, it was a very fierce encounter because they were wild. Because wild gorillas can be quite dangerous. Once they are habituated, then yes, they become the gentle giants that they are. But when they're wild, they can be very frightening. So I think that's where that whole King Kong image came from the people who first hunted them, you know, like the person who first saw the gorilla, then brought it home as a trophy. You know, that, like, for example, the mountain gorillas was Captain Von Beringay. And so in those days, exploration was killing animals and bringing the trophy back home, you know, to Europe or America. It's changed now. Exploration has changed, but that's what it used to be. But in order to kill them, of course, it's had to be a violent encounter. And the poor gorillas got a bad name because of that.
Yeah. No, for sure. And, you know, and I think that, and we're going to talk about conservation and the work that you've done and continuing this journey with you as you walk with gorillas, the journey of a African wildlife vet. You know, as I mentioned at the beginning, we're here in Bujoma, the mecca of mountain gorilla tourism at the edge of Bwindi, impenetrable forest. Yes. And, you know, when you first came to Bwindi, it was very different from what tourists find today. Can you share a little bit about what studying gorillas in those early days was like?
I'd say studying gorillas in the early days was really magical. I'll have to say I'm a bit selfish because there were very few people. Yeah. There were only two habituated gorilla groups, and it was only six people allowed to visit the gorillas per day. So there's a maximum of 12 tourists in any one day. And there were only a few lodges, maybe about five or six lodges. And there was this whole air of hope because people were so hopeful about the gorillas. You know, they're beginning to get jobs as rangers, trackers, porters, and they were selling crafts. They were beginning to sell accommodation and food. And when I came as a vet student to study the parasites and the bacteria in the fecal samples of the gorillas, I'm glad that I was at the tourism site of Bujoma, not the research site. I was based at the tourism site because I got to understand beyond the research that I was doing, comparing the two groups visited by tourists and the one group visited by researchers in Rehija. I also got to learn about the conservation issues. It was a great lesson in conservation because I saw how tourism was contributing to communities and helping to begin to lift them out of poverty. So that was very interesting. Yeah, it was an amazing time. I stayed in a mud hut for the first time in my life, which is very scary because it had a permanently open window and I was alone by myself on the hill. And I was like, I didn't sleep for the first 2 days. And after that, it was great. Everything was much simpler, I would say. But now what you find is there are 22 habituated gorilla groups. In Bujoma sector, there's, I think, about six groups that people can visit. From Bujoma, it's eight people per gorilla group per day. There's over 20 lodges around Bujoma. Everything is much more chaotic. But it's bringing a lot more benefits to the local community. Obviously, very many more people are employed. There's a lot more engagement and employment in the area. But I kind of miss those days when I was, you know, we were just a few of us. And everyone knew each other, and I just miss those days in a way. But it's great to see the developments because when I first started out, most people were staying in mud huts with thatched roofs. But now majority have more permanent houses with iron sheet roof. So tourism has really made an impact in the area. People are really being lifted out of poverty.
Right. And that's important because I think a big piece of your work has been also to integrate well-being of humans with conservation of gorillas. And you've done that through their health and their economic well-being. And so you founded Conservation Through Public Health. And what year did you found this organization?
We founded Conservation Through Public Health in 2003. After I left the Uganda Wildlife Authority in 2000, I got an opportunity to do a zoological medicine residency and master's in specialized vet medicine at North Carolina State University and North Carolina Zoo. And that was a really amazing time because I got a chance to, you know, have more hands-on with the zoo animals. And they also allowed me to come back home and do some research. And that's when I started doing what you could now call One Health. At the time, it wasn't called One Health. It didn't have a name.
Right.
But, you know, I looked at diseases in people going close to gorillas, you know, like tuberculosis in people going close to gorillas and TB in buffalo, cattle and people to see whether they're getting TB from themselves or from cattle or buffalo, you know, like because some of them either through poaching or drinking cow's milk. And it was a really, it opened my eyes to the public health system of Uganda and how it all works. And so at the end of it, that was my master's project at North Carolina State University. So all of this, on top of discovering that gorillas got scabies from the local communities, early on when I first started out as, who was the first vet at the Wildlife Authority, within my first year that happened, and another case happened later on. And so coupled all that information enabled, gave me the confidence to found Conservation Through Public Health, because during the research, I got to understand how the public health system works. So I was able to combine the experience I had as a wildlife vet, plus the conservation issues that I learned about, and combine that with public health. And we founded CTPH in 2003 with my husband, Lawrence, who's a telecom expert, and Stephen Rubanga, who is a vet technician in Ministry of Agriculture.
Yeah. Well, and you know, what I think people might not appreciate is that you were doing One Health before so many of us heard about what that is, you know, and we've only heard about it now that we've gone through COVID. And right. And but you made this connection. And so can you share a little bit about, you mentioned scabies and how that alerted you to the importance of this long before COVID? How is it that a gorilla, a wild mountain gorilla or a habituated mountain gorilla, can catch scabies?
Scabies is a very contagious disease. And actually, when I was at vet school in London, a lot of pets used to get scabies or sarcoptic mange. Mm-hmm. But their owners never used to get it from them. Or they'll get it as an occasional infection, a temporary infection. But because they're not closely related, it didn't really affect the owner. So when they told me the gorillas were losing hair and developing white scaly skin, having been taught that common things occur commonly, I went to visit a human doctor friend of mine who had also done her training in London. She had done her training as a medical doctor in London, maybe a few years before I completed my training as a vet in London, a family friend called Dr. Catherine Sozi. So when I went to visit her, I asked her, what is the most common skin disease in people? And she said, scabies. And I was like, whoa. She said, yeah, in Uganda, it's common because low-income groups of people often get scabies because of poor hygiene and they don't wash their clothes often. So I thought to myself, well, if it's scabies, I'm going to carry ivermectin with me because it treats all parasites, both ecto and endoparasites. And then when we got to Bwindi, luckily the time that we did the intervention on that particular group where they were all scratching, I went with a very experienced vet from Kenya who had trained the Kenya Wildlife Service vets. And he had seen a similar disease in cheetahs in Masai Mara. But the ones that were visited by very many trucks, many tourist trucks, had scabies, and those that weren't didn't. So we thought, could it be stress? But then we also were joined by two other vets. One was heading St. Louis Zoo, Dr. Eric Miller. And they joined us together with Dr. Richard Koch and also Dr. Mary Jane Goss, who was a small animal veterinarian. And as a small animal vet, you see lots of scabies cases. And so between the four of us, we were able to think, to say, this looks like scabies. Let's give the gorillas ivermectin. It wasn't later until I could go to a laboratory in Kampala to basically confirm that it was scabies, and it was from the samples we collected. And then we started to ask ourselves, where could they have got it from? And it turns out that whenever gorillas get habituated for tourism or research, they lose their fear of people and they're more likely to leave the park because people cut up their forest habitat. You know, they cut a lot of wood and destroy their forest habitat. And now they started to go back to the places where they used to range before their forest was cut.
Yeah.
And people are cutting it also because of the high human population growth. So we found that both Mubare Group and Katendejere that had scabies were going out of the park a lot.
Okay.
And they were finding that people are putting out dirty clothing on scarecrows, and people don't wash, they're not bathing often anyway because it's difficult to get water. And now they weren't even washing their clothes. And of course, they'll put the worst piece of clothing to scare away the wildlife. And actually, gorillas were not the worst culprit. Baboons are much worse. And well, so we, yeah, we believe that. I know, the baboons are too much, aren't they?
Oh, they are.
And so we believe that the gorillas just touch the clothing because they're very curious, especially the babies. They'll touch anything, just like human babies. And we believe that that's how it spread through the group. But luckily they all recovered from ivermectin, apart from the infant that died. And a few years later, another outbreak occurred in another gorilla group in another part of the park. And again, this was a group that once it got habituated for tourism, started moving outside the park. So that's the problem, is once you habituate them for tourism, Admasaji generates revenue that helps to make the communities happy enough not to, you know, to coexist with them. It presents itself with the risk of human disease, both from the community and the tourists who come to visit them.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the challenges, but it's not the only challenge. In your new book, Walking with Gorillas, you also talk about one gorilla called Kalumbizi, which means explorer in Ruchiga, the local language here. What happened with this gorilla, and how did that contribute to the development of one of the other activities that CTPH is involved with to this day, managing human-gorilla conflict in communities?
Yeah, that was one of the very first cases I had to deal with. I mean, once they told the wardens that we now have a vet, the chief warden of Bwindi at the time, Agnesha Sachoka, called me to the radio and said, we have a problem here. A gorilla is going out and scratching people. And I was like, he said, come and translocate this gorilla. I was like, whoa. And translocating gorillas is not common. I mean, it's like, it's almost unheard of. So I contacted two vets who were working. One of them was in Uganda and one was based in Rwanda. They're working for the Mountain Gorilla Vet Project. And they had darting equipment. I didn't have darting equipment yet because I'd just been hired. They didn't know what a vet does. And then I started fundraising for darting equipment. It hadn't arrived yet. And so we went together with Jonathan, Dr. Jonathan Sliman and Dr. John Bosco Nize to Bwindi. And when we got there, they told us about this story, about this gorilla that's scratching people. And what was upsetting the warden, and that's why he said it's really urgent, is because he was having to pay hospital bills for the people who were scratched by this gorilla.
Okay.
And so he even organized for where we're going to put the gorilla. After we translocate him, we're going to take him to a part of Bwindi that actually didn't have gorillas. But at the time, none of us thought, why doesn't that part of Bwindi have gorillas? We just felt we just need to solve this problem. And we knew that the warden knows best where we should take the gorilla. So we got everything organized. And so the evening before we went to see where the gorilla was, and he had built his nest in the community garden, not far from the road. And when we went there, he charged us a bit. And we're like, okay, we don't want to frighten him too much because we need to find him again tomorrow morning. But in the meantime, having seen how big he was, we got the community to make a bigger stretcher, because during those days, and I think they still have it now, when someone gets sick, the stretchers society carries you to the health center.
Yes.
And so they just made a bigger stretcher for a bigger, you know, the big gorilla. And I remember Jonathan insisted on a mattress because he felt it was going to be comfortable for the gorilla. And he used to work in Tennessee Zoo. So I guess in the zoo in Tennessee. So I guess he was, you know, he was used to a more luxury experience for the animals. And so we got ready to move, and we called him Kalambuzi because he was, and what happened is he was a semi-habituated gorilla. And that's why he was very difficult to manage. They had started to habituate the gorillas there, but it was so steep and they thought, tourists are not going to manage this. So then they stopped.
Okay.
Which is very dangerous because now they've lost their fear of people, but you can't get close enough to them.
Right.
And that's a very dangerous phase. And then he became a lone silverback and he's like, I like being out here in the community. No one's bothering me, you know, and, you know, he's occasionally taking banana plants and stuff. So he was okay there. But the day when we had to dart him, oh my God, he freaked out because when we gave him the first dart, it never really took him down because he was a semi-wild gorilla. So he needed almost double the dose. But we gave him the dose of a fully habituated gorilla and he needed more. And so he went down, he slowed down very slightly and then started running again. And we couldn't get a second dart into him. So by the time he kept running towards the forest because that's where he felt safest. And after 3 hours, he was inside the forest where we wanted him to be. And that's when we realized, whoops, we need to do something about such gorillas like that come out. But that was quite an experience. He went into the forest. He never came back out again. I think he got the fright of his life, chased by people all the way into the forest nonstop. And it was a really tough day for me. And I remember a lovely lady came and pulled me up the hill because I had no more energy. Basically running after the gorilla for 3 hours drained me completely.
Yeah.
And then when we got up there with all the Dr. Liz McPhee, who had given me this opportunity, having been one of the first vets at Mountain Gorilla Vet Project in Rwanda, but now heading International Gorilla Conservation Program in Uganda, which was helping set up tourism and community conservation. She was just like, you guys should not have even tried to translocate this gorilla. And we're like, and she's like, anyway, the fact that you chased him into the forest means we need to develop a team of people who chase gorillas back to the forest.
Yeah.
And then when we all sat down, we felt it needed to be people who are not the rangers because, and also another thing that Liz said, it shouldn't be rangers or vets chasing the gorillas. They get mixed messages. It should be people who they shouldn't be seeing, like the local community. And so we got together a group of community members and they were all excited to be part of it because it also gives them self-esteem in the community. They're doing a community service. And they ended up becoming the Human Gorilla Conflict Resolution Team, who we now call Gorilla Guardians. And they were trained by the Wildlife Authority, International Gorilla Conservation Program, and later CTPH, Conservation Through Public Health, to safely herd gorillas back when they come out. And of course, for us, we're very concerned that when gorillas are in community gardens, like Kalambuzi was, they can pick up diseases from people because there's a lot of open defecation.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do is we make sure that the gorilla guardians collect fecal samples from the gorillas as well so that we test them when they're outside the park and compare it with inside the park and make sure, find out if they're picking up anything from the people or the livestock when they're outside the park. And so it's actually a group that has been around since the late 90s. And yes, we work closely with them and support them with, you know, livelihood projects so that they keep doing what they're doing because they're volunteers. They're not paid a salary.
Wow. That, you know, and I just want to say for the listeners, this is just one of many of the, you know, exciting stories and that are found in your book, Walking with Gorillas. And I know we're coming close to the end of the time because you are such a busy person, but I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned how far gorilla conservation and protection has come, largely as a result of tourism and the work with the communities. You know, has there been heartache for you in this time that you've been working with gorillas?
There has been heartache. I was very, very, there's twice that it happened when gorillas were killed by the local community. That was very painful for me because I just felt you know, these communities are benefiting from tourism. How dare they kill a gorilla? But then, of course, not every community member is benefiting from tourism. And how do we get all community members to benefit from tourism? The first time was a gorilla called Mizano from Habinyanja Group. He was killed by a bushmeat poacher who came in, and he got into a fight with the bushmeat poacher's hunting dog. And so this poacher speared Mizano to death. And unfortunately, the person who killed Mizano only, you know, he left, he wasn't given much. He only stayed in jail for a few days. And he, the magistrate only asked him to pay equivalent of $20, which was really upsetting. And even it was our village health and conservation teams who we trained to go to community households who told me, can you imagine, he only had to pay, you know, 50,000 shillings, which is equivalent to $20 at the time. And so we spoke to the Uganda Wildlife Authority, and everybody was outraged. And so they started to educate the magistrates that a gorilla is very important. If you someone kills it, it's a lot, you know, this is a very endangered species. And not only that, it's, you know, not only is the gorilla critically endangered, but it's helping to lift people out of poverty. It's very important to Uganda. So then during the COVID pandemic, Rafiki, who's called Rafiki because he's friendly, got killed by a hungry bushmeat poacher. And this poacher came in, he speared the bush pig, and the bush pig screamed, and Rafiki charged because he was trying to protect his family, and the poacher speared Rafiki to death, which was terrible. He didn't mean to eat Rafiki. He said he speared him out of self-defense, but he shouldn't have been there in the first place. It was a time when there was no tourism, it was complete lockdown during COVID. And that, again, I was just like, come on, Rafiki has done so much for the southern sector. Everyone knows Rafiki. In fact, when we went to check on Rafiki's group, because now they were no longer headed by a silverback, some females left the group, and the group was very wary. The porter who took me to the gorillas had a mask saying, in memory of Rafiki. A lot of community members were very upset with this bushmeat poacher. But then, you know, so those were the times when I really felt a lot of heartache. But what we did is, you know, for the case of Rafiki, we made sure that the communities get fast growing seedlings, because people are poaching because they were hungry, which we found out when we distributed them and did a questionnaire, including the poacher's wife, because her husband was sent to jail for 11 years, which is the longest anyone has ever gone to jail for killing gorillas, duiker, and bush pigs. So it was kind of a victory for conservation, but as long as you have very many hungry people around, it's going to happen again. So it's just been heartache, but it's made us realize that not everyone's benefiting, and we need to dig deeper to find out the reason why people are poaching. Not everybody can be part of the tourism industry. Some people are not able to be part of it, and they still need to go into the forest to poach. And we've discovered that actually with Gorilla Conservation Coffee, why we started it as well is we found that some of these farmers never got a good price for their coffee, and they were still entering the park to poach. And so, yes, we just have to find different ways to reduce this, you know, this poaching and human wildlife conflicts.
Yeah. Well, and the work of CTPH and you is having such an impact. And we are almost out of time. And I just, you know, this is Women's Month. And one of the things that is so inspiring is not only are you a woman, but you were the first female wildlife veterinarian for the Ugandan Wildlife Authority. And, you know, do you think that, do you feel a sense of responsibility for young women, both inside and outside of Uganda, to look at you as a role model?
Yes, I do feel a sense of responsibility, actually. I know that I have inspired a number of women to get into conservation and to become wildlife vets. And recently we did some wildlife work on a project that we're doing together with our Uganda Wildlife Authority and the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Agriculture. And we were collecting samples. The head vet, actually, who I trained a number of years ago, Dr. Eric Enyel, he was training some vet students and newly qualified vets. And I was so touched when they were all women. I was like, wait, this is pretty amazing. And I was so touched when they told me that I inspired them to become wildlife vets and to get interested in wildlife. So yes, I do feel a responsibility. If they see more women doing those kind of things and they feel if a woman can do it, then I can. I was very inspired by Dr. Jane Goodall, the late Dr. Diane Fossey, although I never met her, but I got an opportunity to meet Dr. Jane Goodall, who's written the foreword for Working with Gorillas. Very exciting. And also Dr. Birute Gaudikas.
Yes.
And who first studied orangutans. They've really inspired me. And many other women, including Dr. Liz McPhee, who's probably the first female vet with Mountain Gorilla Vet Project in Rwanda. But also some people who I never got to meet, like Professor Wangari Maathai, and a number of women. There's not that many women actually in conservation, but I think the number is growing and it's inspiring others. I'm on the Women for Environment Leadership Council, which was initiated by Dr. Lila Haza, she's a co-founder of Lion Guardians. And she felt that there were very few women in leadership positions in the conservation and environment space. And this was impacting conservation. And so now what we do is we mentor women in middle and senior management positions, especially senior management positions, so that they can fulfill their leadership potential. Because we need to have more women heading conservation institutions or in leadership positions in order to encourage others to follow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's so important. And I know that you are so busy. And I just want to remind listeners to please go get your copy of Walking with Gorillas, The Journey of an African Wildlife Vet. You won't be disappointed. And I thank you so much, Dr. Gladys Kalimazukusoka, for being on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Dr. Jennifer Bredelin. And we've also enjoyed hosting you in Bwindi and at CTPH as a Fulbright scholar. And I'm so excited to be on this show with you. Thank you.
For the past 8 months, I've been living here in Bwindi Impenetrable Forest National Park in southwestern Uganda. And even though it has been incredibly challenging, not just from the perspective of the social isolation and understanding different cultural norms, but environmentally, it's also really difficult. Now, they call it the impenetrable forest, but there are parts you can penetrate, and then there are parts you can't. One of the most special things has been to see such diverse wildlife. Bwindi Impenetrable Forest is a biodiversity hotspot. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And aside from the vast diversity of birds, there are so many different species of primate, not just the mountain gorillas, but chimpanzees, red-tailed monkeys, yellow-tailed monkeys, los monkeys, black and white colobus monkeys. And it's been such a joy to be able to see so many different species and to find a place where a lot of wildlife is thriving. There are challenges for sure. And part of what's helping to preserve the park and preserve the gorillas and the other wildlife that's here is tourism. But as Dr. Gladys Kalimazukusoka discussed, tourism isn't always benefiting everybody. So we need to find other ways to be able to uplift these communities. And that's part of what my Fulbright has been about. Now, next week, what we have is an author, Lisa Randolph, who wrote a book about Bwindi Impenetrable Forest and what it's like to trek the gorillas, all wrapped up in a wonderful story about some young women who are on missions to rescue wildlife. So tune in next week for that episode. Don't forget, you can check out Wild Connection, the podcast on Podbean for the show notes, or my website, jennifervertelin.com. In the show notes, you'll find all the links to follow CTPH, Dr. Gladys, where to buy her new book, and all the social media links you could dream of. Thanks for listening.